Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We are back after a short little break. And we're all over the place today. Andrew Hahn is actually in Miami, where he's definitely only doing recruiting at the NABJ convention and definitely not enjoying the Miami nightlife because he's a pro's pro. Joining us from Los Angeles is Kevin Arnovitz. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, how are you?
Kevin is soon to depart on a fabulous European vacation, but we're squeezing out some work from him in the meantime. Joining us from Oklahoma City is Royce Young, although Royce, according to your wife's Instagram, you were recently at Disney World or Disneyland?
World. Team World.
World. Team World. All right. Sounds good. Was that a good trip?
Oh, man. I mean, to take the Disney employee hat even off here and put it aside, Disney World's awesome. Great fun for the whole family, everybody.
We should check that out. I've never heard of that, Disney World. I'm in Las Vegas with Team USA, where your finest NBA players are preparing to go defend their World Cup championship. Okay, so they're not the finest, but they're all really good players. But I want to start today talking about actually a move. This is not something I thought we were going to do, but talking about a move that the NCAA made yesterday. Kevin, I assume that you saw this. I'd be interested to get your opinion on it. So they haven't, I don't think, formally announced it. It was reported by CBS and some other outlets, I think Yahoo as well, that the NCAA is, there's a new rule that high school players can consult an agent about whether they should turn pro or not before they, and not lose their eligibility. But those agents have to be certified by the NCAA, and the certification rules were leaked yesterday, or at least became public. And they included that you had to be a college graduate, which is going to potentially exclude some agents, including Rich Paul, who is one of the most successful NBA agents. Kevin, did you have a reaction to that when you saw that?
This is the first I'm hearing of it. So,
I'm
on my summer diet, Brian, which is only occasional forays into my news feed. I mean, that seems a little bizarre that if you're going to professionalize, so you're going to professionalize this process by making it above board, but then you're going to put this very strange prerequisite, which is that you have to finish a four-year, presumably a two- or four-year degree.
I think it just said a bachelor's degree, so I don't think a two-year degree can be a bachelor's degree. So I think it's – I mean, I'm not an educator, so I can't say for sure, but I think that was implied it was a four-year degree.
So the NCAA is suggesting, if I'm hearing this correctly, that unless you have a bachelor's degree, you're ill-equipped to advise potential professional basketball players on the various routes available to them. While I'm somebody who values education, that does seem to me to be a little incongruent with, given that LeBron James would be ineligible to advise a kid on, on where they could go and what available options exist for them to go play basketball or not play basketball or play it here or play it there. That means we could come up with a very formidable list of people who would be ineligible to advise in an official capacity under this rule. I mean, this is the NCAA setting this out?
Yeah, and you have to be an NBA Players Association approved agent for 3 years. So, you wouldn't just be anybody coming in off the street. I mean, it would have to be somebody who the NBA – but it seems a little bit strange that the NBPA would sort of endorse somebody, but the NCAA would not. And what this just reeks of is an attempting end run around Rich Paul, who has taken several – I think he's got two clients who he got out of high school – and didn't go to college and are now one just got drafted, Darius Blaisley.
It's particularly rich, Brian, because we know how much the NCAA cares about education of young men. They're so committed to that, to the pure virtue of educating young men, or young women for that matter. So that's my first reaction. It's cynicism, as is my reaction to most things that come out of the National Collegiate Athletic Association,
which is as much of a racket as anything else in the larger constellation of pro sports and amateur.
It also feels to me like it's criteria for the sake of criteria, doesn't it? Like it's like some measures that you had to hit, and they all put their heads together, and it was like, well, what are some things that people would have to do? And they just I understand that it feels like it's targeting someone like Rich Paul. It also feels to me like they kind of just thin air to say, like, how about these things? Because they don't really seem to make sense to me in terms of, like, what impact for somebody that was wanting to advise.
Yeah, so it reminds me a little bit of when I was covering LeBron James in high school, and he was banned by the State Athletic Association because he had taken a couple of free jerseys. He posed for some photos at, like, a clothing store. They gave him, at that time, throwback jerseys were really, really popular and really expensive. And they gave him a couple of free jerseys for doing it, and that they were worth some ungodly amount of money. I mean, they were, it was the market. It wasn't that the material was worth that much, but whatever. And their rules for, you know, governing a player like LeBron basically came down to two sentences in their bylaws, and they were completely ill-equipped to handle it. And so they threw their arms up, even though LeBron was driving incredible amount of money for everyone around him except for himself, and they banned him. And he went to court, and he won within like a couple of days. He had to sit out one game, and they had to forfeit a game. But it was laughable. And really, the thing is that association, you know, they were representing like 500 schools. They couldn't get their mind around someone taking power from them, and they were not equipped to it. And so the NCAA, as an organization, which, you know, represents hundreds and hundreds of schools, multiple divisions. I mean, I think all in all, as an organization, does a lot of good things. But the top 1%, they don't do a very good job with. But the top 1% is where they get like 99% of their revenue. So it all comes down to the top 1%. And so this, to me, sounds like a rule that was made to govern, you know, the other 99% that makes no sense when dealing with the top 1%, and it follows along the lines of governing bodies I've seen over the last 20 years who feel threatened, you know, and let's just be flat honest, in a lot of cases feel threatened by minorities taking power from a more mostly white establishment. I mean, I can't say that's the entire thing here, but let's just be clear, that's what it is. It certainly felt that way when LeBron was in high school. And it kind of has that feel now because Rich Paul comes from a background that your historic sports agent doesn't, yet he is being very, very successful. So I wouldn't be surprised if they – since these rules were not officially announced, I'll be interested to see if they stick with it or if they amend it, because there's been pretty strong pushback. And I also saw that Jason Glushon – he has a small agency, but he's a very successful agent. He represents Drew Holiday and Al Horford, two very good players on huge contracts, $100 million contracts, each of them. He put out a statement condemning it as well, and he has made good points. So I just wanted to cover that real quick because I just feel like I needed to say that. So I'm in Vegas with Team USA. There's 30 players here. 15 guys, or 29, I guess. 15 guys are on the Team USA roster. There's 14 on the select team. We're 2 days into practice, and you'll be happy to know, Kevin, that yesterday at practice, Greg Popovich, we get to watch a little bit of it, more than we get to watch of an NBA practice. Greg Popovich was preaching 0.5, 0.5, 0.5. Which is the Spurs rule that you make a decision to shoot or pass in 0.5 seconds. The worst thing you can do is not take a shot or make a bad pass or make it, you know, take a bad shot, is to hold the ball. And so Pop is out there, 0.5, 0.5, 0.5. He really wants this team to look and operate like the San Antonio Spurs, which I guess shouldn't be a surprise.
Right, and it actually conforms very much to international ball. right? In some ways, the Spurs of 13, 14, and they play a little different now, right? LaMarcus Aldridge is not exactly Mr. Point Five. Rudy Gay, DeMar DeRozan are not Mr. Point Five, but their best teams always operated on the notion that, look, we're not going to have the best talent. We're certainly not going to have the most athleticism, but one thing we can do is make decisions really quickly. And the cool thing about basketball is the ball moves faster than people, right? And so that you can always, that there's this notion that you can, no matter what group of players you can assemble on a team and whether they're as good or not as good, but one thing that you can leverage is your ability to make decisions really quickly in the half court, in the open court. And, this is very throwbacky. Beat you with the past 2014 San Antonio Spurs, ain't it?
Well, you know what it is. The two best passing teams I've ever seen, me, I'm not saying they're the two best passing teams of all time, but the two best passing teams I've ever personally witnessed were the Argentinian national team in 2004, 2005, 2006.
I think they won that championship, right?
2002, but I didn't see them play back then. So, I mean, I'm sure they played the same way. But they won the 2004 gold medal and then reached the semifinals of the World Cup in 2006. And of course, there was a common thread between the Argentinian national team and the Spurs. And that was actually a couple. There was two, but one player for sure, a plucky guard named Manu Ginobili. And I remember watching that Argentinian team play. Now, I have to say that those guys had played together since they were, 12 years old. And, the part of the golden generation of Argentina, which includes Messi. But they could have played their offense in the dark because they always knew where everybody was going to be. It was a mastery to watch, and Greg Popovich was so impressed by it, by watching Argentina, that he tried to duplicate it. And he came pretty close because their 2014 team played some of the most beautiful basketball you've ever seen. Now, let's be honest, Royce, this team doesn't have great isolation star players. Kevin Durant is not on this team. LeBron James is not on this team. James Harden is not on this team. They don't have the isolation stars. Okay, so Greg Popovich, I actually think, in a strange way, I don't think he'd ever admit it, I think he prefers it this way, because I think he can, if he doesn't have those superstars, okay, it may reduce the level of interest from your average basketball fan in the summer, but I think he kind of prefers this team, and that's the kind of interesting thing that I'm noticing a couple of days into this camp.
It just feels like a very Spursy team, doesn't it? When you look at a lot of the roster, it kind of mimics in some ways, I think, how the Spurs have played in recent years. You have some good ball handlers, some good passers. You have a decent mix of shooters, smart defenders. Like you said, Brian, I don't think that it's the type of team that's going to necessarily get anyone excited. As of this morning, before I even really looked at who was on the roster, I didn't even really know. I could have named you like four guys that were going to be on the team. I was quite surprised when I looked at it and say, oh, Bam Adebayo is on the roster. Kyle Kuzma is on the roster. I didn't know that they'd actually made it. So,
they may not make it, but they're in training camp.
Right. Fair enough. But whatever the mix of the team is, it does seem to me that this type of team could play a style that is successful. I think that there's some skepticism that Team USA, I don't think I would, you would know better, Brian, but I mean, I don't think that they're the favorite for the tournament necessarily at this point. Maybe they are
they're
Team USA. They
are. They're not like, so the odds here in Vegas about two, three weeks ago before all the players dropped out, they were about a 1 to, like if you wanted to bet on them to win the tournament.
Really that much?
They were a 1 to 5 favorite.
That's surprising to me.
Bet $500 to win $100. So not a good bet. And they are now down to about a 1 to 2.2 favorite. So you'd bet like 225. One book has them at 225. Basically bet 225 to win 100. Another book has them at 250 to win 100. So basically the bookmakers have cut them in half. It's still a heavy favorite, but Serbia has surged, and they are now the strong candidate. Now Serbia, obviously, Bojan Bogdanovic, Nikola Jokic, Milos Teodosic. Jokic is their big star. But, yeah, so they're still the heavy favorites. But I don't know if a lot of people are really paying attention because James Harden, Anthony Davis, Damian Lillard, guys like that dropped out.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think that in some ways, it, for me at least, it makes the tournament more exciting and intriguing when it feels like it's competitively balanced. It reminds me a little bit, Brian, of the – I'm probably going to get my year wrong – the 2010 World Cup maybe? Or I don't know what it was called.
I was going to ask you about that. You want to talk about what happened with Kevin Durant in that World Cup?
Yeah, I mean, he was unbelievable. I mean, and basically just ran the tournament, right? And that was in Turkey, I believe. Wasn't that one in Turkey?
Yeah, so as a real quick – so you remember the 2008 was the Redeem Team. They lost in the Olympics. They had also lost the previous three, I think, World Cups. So they, you know, brought in Coach K, you know, loaded up the team, got Kobe Bryant, LeBron, like one of the great teams of all time, probably the second greatest team other than the Dream Team. And they go and they win, and it was a very intense game with Spain, with the Gasol brothers at their peak, Kobe made some big shots down the fourth quarter to win. They're called the Redeem Team. All 12 guys decide not to come back in 2010 for the World Cup in Turkey. They just, you know, they're like, we can't do any better than this, we're done. And so they had this whole new team, and there was some of this same stuff, like, boy, there's no superstars playing. Why do we even care? You mean we got to play with Steph Curry? He's going to get minutes.
Right.
Derrick Rose is going to be their starting point guard. Derrick Rose, I mean, he's good. He's got decent numbers, but is he their starting point? He won the MVP the next season. And then Durant went over there, and in the final, Turkey actually got to the final. So just think about playing Turkey in Istanbul in the World Championship game. And you imagine the crowd. The crowd was, of course, just and the Turkish crowd is intense anyway. And this is their big, giant moment. And Durant dropped, I think, 38 in a 40-minute game.
The short three-point line was just unfair for Durant.
Right. But Durant just absolutely – by the end of the game, I wasn't there, but I was talking – I've talked to people who were there. By the end of the game, the Turkish fans, they just started cheering for him. Because they were just so blown away. It's probably, you know, one of the great moments of Kevin Durant's career that nobody will ever remember except for maybe the people who were there and Durant himself. Again, with a team that allegedly had no stars.
That's the thing to me, Brian, is that, you know, there's been a lot of hand-wringing about this current team and who's dropped out and who's not part of it. And I kept thinking about that 2010 team because it was extremely similar to that. And I know that Durant himself viewed it as a huge opportunity, and that's what he saw it as, that not only as an opportunity to get around, you know, peers to train that were similar age as him, but also high-level coaching, to be able to think the game a little bit more. And, you know, when you're looking for summer training, it doesn't get a whole lot better than that. So, I mean, it is kind of surprising that some of these players, you know, when you look at some of the names that have dropped out, I kind of wonder, like, why aren't you wanting to be part of this? But because of, to see what value it was for some of those young players. But, you know, it is kind of funny to look back at that roster, the 2010 team, and to what people thought was kind of a ho-hum group. It turns out there was a lot of good players on the team, and it's probably we're going to reflect back on this team in a similar manner when it's Jason Tatum or Donovan Mitchell or De'Aaron Fox or whoever it is. We're probably going to look back and say that 2019 team had some players on it.
Is available to take your call.
Andrew, I heard a story about you in Vegas when you were here for Summer League, and you, am I correct in saying that you tripled down on eights? You had two eights in blackjack and you actually tripled down on that?
Yeah, you always split aces and eights.
Right, so but then you split them again, right?
Right, and then double down. I love stories against about me and Vegas, so this is great.
and what? And against what was the dealer showing?
The dealer was showing a five.
Well, it's hard to win three hands, even against a five. But Andrew did, because the dealer busted. And you know what also is hard? Finding qualified job candidates, because it takes a long time and there's too many applicants. And that's how ZipRecruiter makes your life easier. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply for your job. Just like that, dealer invited Andrew to go ahead and double down after he already had three bets on the table. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you'll never miss a great match. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at, of course, this address. You know what it is. ZipRecruiter.com/collective. That's ZipRecruiter.com/collective. And since it's the summer, we'll remind you the collective is spelled C-O-L-L-E-C-T-I-V-E. We didn't really have to, but, you know, just for some of you guys out there. ZipRecruiter.com/collective, because ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire.
Hello, no one is available to take your call.
Kevin, so one of the things that's going on right now, there are four Celtics here. It wasn't supposed to be that way. When this team was first put together, Kemba Walker was a Hornet. And Jason Tatum was on the roster from the start. And then when all those guys dropped out, they extended invitations to Jaylen Brown and Marcus Smart. Now, Jaylen Brown and Marcus Smart are fighting for roster spots. It's too early to tell who's going to make it and who's not. They have another week or so to decide. But these guys have been going out to meals together. They are trying to spend as much time around each other. And I've talked to them, and they're all saying good things. Now, they're not saying it directly, but they're kind of using coded language a little bit about chemistry, basically saying, you know, last year we didn't have very good chemistry, and they're basically saying we had Kyrie Irving, and now we have Kemba Walker, and so we're going to try to take advantage, whether this is a week or whether this is 6 weeks, to be together to try to correct the errors and the issues that we had with our point guard last year with our new point guard this year.
No, it strikes me as a great, whether it's unintentional, certainly it's unintentional in the sense that Team USA has no skin in the Celtics game. But it strikes me as a great unintentional display of team building, right? You get these four guys, and I imagine that the camp, we call it camp, and it is a little bit like summer camp, right? Like these guys are off in Vegas, kind of on a desert island. They alternate between hotel, practice, various sanction and promotional events. Yeah, they go out, but by and large, it is sort of like being at summer camp. You're on a desert island together. That's kind of how it's been described to me in past years. And it strikes me that you can imagine, Brian, if you and I and Royce are talking in kind of January 20th, and the Celtics are, you know, 39 and 19, and are well planted within the upper echelon of the Eastern Conference, that you imagine us kind of looking back onto camp, Team USA camp, as being sort of this factor in their ability to kind of come together and become a force. And in that sense, it is funny if we will look back on Team USA as being this Celtics incubator of chemistry.
Reading your story this morning, plug your story because that's exactly what you wrote about for ESPN.com. But in reading it this morning, the thing that jumped out to me immediately is what you kind of referenced, the whole, you know, trying to kind of politely skirt the factor of three of those Celtics were on the team last year. There's one guy that wasn't. So, you know, there's some built-in right. chemistry between three of them, but right. there's one new guy, and one new guy is quite a bit different in terms of personality than the other guy that he's replacing.
Yeah, Jaylen Brown, he tried to be artful when he said, he was like, look, we're trying to focus on basketball. We're not focusing on, you know, he didn't mean actual politics. He's like, I don't want to worry about politics. He didn't mean like the politics of the country. He meant like politics on the team. And they're trying to, do stuff
maybe
on basketball.
Talking about better care for all. It's entirely possible.
That's, I can't rule it out. Pop is here. Pop and Steve Kerr are here. I kind of, got the impression they're like, let's just cut the, you know what and focus on playing together. And I think the phrase he must really like this because he said it three times in our little 6-minute interview. He said, it's a new season. It's a new, we said we're artists and it's a new canvas. Basically we're going to throw last year away. So, Brad Stevens is going to be here today and I would assume going to be spending some time with those guys. So that's just interesting. There's this little Celtic subplot, that's happening here. And, but when you look at this team and you look around, you look at the room, I mean, I've been coming to Team USA summer training camps for a decade now, more than a decade. And I will say, this is the least star power we've ever had here. You have three all-stars, which are Chris Middleton, Kemba Walker, and Kyle Lowry. Lowry is not playing, and he's questionable at best of playing on this team because he's got a thumb issue. it is, Lowry is interesting, by the way, as a quick aside. So there's so many guys who are begging off this team, and they have their reasons. Some guys are banged up. Some guys are worried about having to go to Asia twice in a row because there's six teams going to Asia in training camp this year, and they either have to go to China, come back, go back to India. There's two kings on this roster right now, Harrison Barnes and De'Aaron Fox, who would have to go to Asia, go to China, come home, then go to India. There would be back-to-back summers because there's a new schedule. The World Cup and Olympics are played back-to-back, and these star players don't want to give up 6 weeks of their time back-to-back summers. There's a bunch of legitimate reasons, and there's some, sort of illegitimate reasons guys are begging off, but whatever, they did it. Here you got Kyle Lowry, who played longer than anybody. He played into June, won the championship, had surgery on his thumb, okay, is already got a gold medal with Team USA. He was on the 2016 team, so he's got equity. He doesn't have to play to improve his chances of playing next year on the Olympic team. Is going over to Asia in training camp, because the Raptors are playing in Japan, I believe against the Rockets. And yet he is here trying to play. He is like the outlier amongst outliers, and I don't know if he's going to be able to. But I'll just say that.
Kyle, Brian, right? Like, that's Kyle. Kyle is a guy who watches games on his off night. And I think it's always interesting, and I think every industry is the same way. There are people who, even when they're allegedly off, are not really off. Like, the milieu, the career, that's where they hang out even by their own volition. And then you have guys who's just like, they're going to unplug. It's 3-2-1 Cancun. And by the way, I don't think one's better than the other. But Kyle is a guy who, again, assistant coaches will tell you, he's texting about sets other teams are running on an off night when he's watching League Pass, because the guy just is obsessed with basketball. And it's not a surprise that Lowry's that guy. And it's also, I mean, it's interesting. Brian, let me ask you, do you think that, entering the last year of a deal, or do we think there are any other ulterior motives informing it like that?
Good question. I mean, he did, he talked to Ohm Youngmasuk, who's here helping me cover this. And I think he also mentioned to SI that he would be open to a contract extension this summer. Of course he would, but the Raptors have not talked to him about it. The Raptors are kind of, to me, here's my viewpoint of the Raptors. They're going to come back with this team, see how it goes, and decide what to do. Are they going to start a retrofit mid-year? Will they put Marc Gasol, Serge Ibaka, and Kyle Lowry on the block and make them available? If they don't, Kyle has come out and said he feels like they can still be competitive. I still think that they're going to be a team with teeth, as I say, because you still do have a really good, great core, and it's going to be a moment for Pascal Siakam to really step forward, I believe. But I also think the Raptors are going to keep their options open because all those guys are on the last year of their contracts, and there's a natural refresh that they could do, and they've got their title. They have nothing to prove. So Kyle's preference would be to remain in Toronto and get one more big contract. I don't know if that's feasible, but, there have been other times when, there have been other times in this last 5 years where Masai Ujiri thought he was breaking this team up. you know, and they kept, you know, Kyle kept sticking together. He kept keeping Kyle. You know, they almost traded him to the Knicks 1 year. Then he was a free agent, and it looked like there was going to be a big market for him. Then the market dried up, and the Raptors kind of kept him, sort of unsure. And so that's an interesting thing that we'll watch early in the season.
Yeah, Brian, he's like Kyle Lowry's one of the great accidental lifers, you know, with one team. Because as you said, that was never really a chosen destination. You know, he wasn't the guy brought in by the guy running the team. You know, he was inherited by Ujiri. And yet, I can't think of a guy in the league who's more synonymous with a team where it's kind of a function of circumstance and just sort of arbitrary timing. Like, he is truly the accidental lifer in Toronto.
When Masai Ujiri took over the team, you know, he's like, I'm trading Bargnani. He traded Rudy Gay, and he was about to trade Kyle Lowry. He was in the middle of a roster makeover. And the Rudy Gay trade, which was to the Kings, ended up, like, making the team a lot better. And then the Knicks didn't execute the Kyle Lowry trade, which has been covered ad nauseum, you know, because of the scar tissue of, you know, frankly, I've talked to people with the Knicks. It wasn't just the scar tissue from the Bargnani trade. It was also because they didn't think Kyle Lowry was a guy that they wanted on their team, because he had a history in Memphis and in Houston and even a little bit in Toronto of being hard to deal with. And he still is hard to deal with. He happens also to be a fabulous player and a champion, but he was hard to deal with, and they also didn't want to do it.
It was Ujiri. We'll talk about how when he came in, it was the, you know, Alex Rucker and that analytics team would come into Masai Ujiri's office and say, you have no idea how important this guy is to winning. Right? Like I know the stats from a raw standpoint aren't necessarily all that impressive, but trust us when we tell you that this guy affects winning in ways that you do not see. And, you know, to Masai Ujiri's credit, he kind of got on that wagon pretty quickly. He wasn't always on it 100%. As you say, I mean, there are times where, you know, whether you look at Kyle Lowry's size, whether you look at the fact that he can be a little cantankerous, or whatever it might be, that you can always talk yourselves into reasons why Kyle Lowry isn't the right guy to lead your team, right? And I think, you know, whether it is size, whether it's temperament, whether it is, maybe he's not a great shooter, but, it's just, he's had, one of the things I love, one of my favorite things about the Toronto championship is just sort of what it's done for Kyle Lowry's career and sort of the conversation around Kyle Lowry. Cause I truly think he's one of the most interesting players in the last 10 to 15 years, just in terms of sheer biography, journey, measuring, like, he's a great flashpoint for all the debates we love to have on shows like this, you know, like, no stat all-star, or is he big enough, or is it all about, you know, like, he's a fascinating player. I hope he gets another deal in Toronto, and I also fully acknowledge that it might not be the right way for them to go going forward, depending on what happens.
Hello, no one is available to take your call.
Let's talk about a couple of challenging things. One, staying cool in Vegas in the summer. It takes a lot of focus, hard work, and frankly, a lot of help. And also hiring. How about that transition? That's what you get when you get to a professional like me. Hiring is challenging. But there's one place where you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. Let's take a guess. What place do you think that is? It's ZipRecruiter. Of course, that's a place where growing businesses connect to get their qualified candidates. They send your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but of course they don't stop there. They've got that powerful matching technology. It goes through all those resumes, finds the people, sends them your job, and when the applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes all of them, finds the people that you really want to talk to so that you never miss that great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers, that's 80%, that's Andrew Hahn's loss rate at Blackjack, who post on ZipRecruiter, get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And, of course, our Hoop Collective listeners can try ZipRecruiter's great service for free at ZipRecruiter.com/collective. ZipRecruiter.com/collective, because ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire.
Hello, no one is available to take your call.
So one guy who's not here, and Jerry Colangelo, who runs USA Basketball, made it clear that it was not really ever a serious consideration, is Carmelo Anthony. And that's a bit of a flashpoint. Boy, is this a time for Melo defenders, Melo lovers to be in their bunker. And Royce Mello gave that interview on First Take last week. We talked a little bit about the Thunder, and you obviously covered him for that season. What did you think about the way Mello talked about his Thunder tenure, and how do you think that played?
First of all, Brian, I think that Mello handled himself really well in the interview, and I think that he attempted to be as thoughtful and transparent as he possibly could be. Now, with that said, I feel like I'm like teeing it up to say, but however, I think a lot of what he said about his Thunder tenure was pretty ridiculous, honestly. I think that he was trying to rewrite reality of what kind of actually happened. You know, he talked about how he felt like the Thunder needed to be more transparent with him, specifically Billy Donovan, about coming off the bench. If they wanted him to come off the bench, they just needed to be up front and tell him that. And like I said, I found that to be, quite frankly, ridiculous, because that's just entirely rewriting what actually happened. And I'll take you back to a transcript that is readily available to read at his exit interview. There were cameras there. There were recorders running, reporters sitting in the room. And Carmelo Anthony said this: "Yeah, I'm not sacrificing no bench role, so you can, that's out of the question." So like, in that regard, for Carmelo Anthony, I think, to sit there and say, "Hey, I was actually totally fine coming off the bench. You guys just had to ask me." That was never the message that he projected to the Thunder, whether publicly or privately. That was a bridge too far, because that was a conversation the team itself was having on a regular basis. They felt like that they could play a little bit more to the identity that they needed. They, you know, they tried different times, Brian, to stagger Mello with the second unit to give him that look and feel, kind of make him a pseudo starter so that he could have his name called when the game started, but then essentially turn him into a bench player. They tried all those different types of things. The hard, cold truth of it all is that Carmelo Anthony just kind of flat out stunk that season. He played the role that I think a lot of people wanted him to play, which you could call him Olympic Mello. He was a catch and shoot stretch four. He just shot the ball really poorly. He did not shoot it well when he was open. He was uncomfortable not having the ball in his hands, going, you know, 3-4 minutes at a time, not getting the ball and having, you know, ISO post-ups or whatever. He looked uncomfortable pretty consistently. And so for him to sit there and kind of now try to rewrite it and say, actually, and I get why he's doing it. He's trying to let everybody know, like, hey, I'm an easy guy to get along with. I can be a team player, and I could have been with the Thunder if they just would have let me. That's just not the truth of what actually happened.
Like, there's this, the conversation's kind of frustrating around Carmelo, because there's sort of these competing truths. One is that he has incredible cultural resonance with a ton of fans, right? This is a guy whose story, whose journey, so many different people admire. And at the same time, like, I think it's fair to ask, if you're looking to fill out a roster, you know, what does this guy do really well right now? And even some of the claims that, oh, but he can go get you a bucket. Well, when you kind of look right down the isolation stats, like, no, he's a slightly below league average ISO player at this point in his career. And as Royce said, you know, not a great shooter. He's not going to defend. One of his great attributes as a player was rebounding. And it feels nitpicky to say this, and I understand why people who find him such a culturally resonant basketball player just get really annoyed with this. But the problem is that if you're an NBA GM, your job in late summer is not to honor the legacy of players with great cultural resonance. Your job is to find a player who can fit into a role quite snugly, and, by the way, somebody whose expectations don't need to be managed. And I think that's the thing when you talk to, you know, why did the Los Angeles Clippers go get Pat Patterson and not Carmelo Anthony, right? We're talking about a modern four, somebody off the bench. And the answer is I don't know that Pat at this point is any better a player than Carmelo. But one thing I know about Patrick Patterson is his expectations don't need to be managed in any real way, right? Like he doesn't, and that is, when you talk to executives around the league, I mean, that's the problem, is my coach has enough to do, right? It's getting harder and harder to make, we talk about culture all the time, how fragile and precarious it is. Why introduce a variable that you know that several of the last several years has ended up being something that needs to be managed from an expectation standpoint? I mean, why do that to your coach? Now, the answer is you do that because you're going to go get a ton of buckets. But if you're not going to get a ton of buckets, if there isn't a lot of recent evidence that he's not going to shoot well, then the cost-benefit analysis is just so not in Carmelo's favor. And I don't think that takes anything away from the power he has as a presence,
as a citizen of the NBA, his contributions to the game historically. But just NBA GMs aren't in the business of honoring legacies with their 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th positions.
That's true. And Kevin's got to actually run off because he's got a full day here. So thanks, Kevin. I appreciate it. What I'd say, Royce, that interview I do think was honest. He was trying to be as honest as he could. I thought Stephen A., look, what do you want me to say? He's my colleague. I thought Stephen A. handled the interview pretty well.
He asked all the right questions.
He was not afraid to ask him.
Yeah.
He asked him some tough questions. He did not let him off the hook on some stuff. But if you're a team, like, you know, the reason Carmelo did that interview was not to have good first take content, which it was good first take content. It was basically to give his pitch directly to NBA teams about why he wanted, why he would be an option. And, you know, there could be a team that does ultimately decide to sign him. Although having said that, he's been available to anybody who would want him since last November. And, you know, he talks about, I can't believe there's not 30 teams that don't, that couldn't use me. I couldn't be somewhere. You know, all 30 teams have had a chance to have him for a long time and have not done that. But one of the things that I took away from the interview was, if I'm a GM who's considering bringing him in, or if I'm a coach, I heard him, I wouldn't say he blamed the Thunder, but he, you know, had sort of an explanation of, like, you know, why the Thunder, it didn't work with him in the Thunder, and it wasn't really his fault. He had an explanation of why it didn't work with the Rockets, and it kind of wasn't his fault. He, you know, I wouldn't say, I mean, would you say he threw Daryl Morey under the bus? I mean, he certainly
I think he did the same. Yeah, I think he did with Presti a little bit as well, kind of saying that he felt like that exit wasn't handled well, you know. Which, and at the time, Brian, again, both sides, both Carmelo and his agent and the Thunder, felt great about the way that they worked kind of collaboratively in getting him to Atlanta, then to Houston.
Yeah, he, you know, they traded him to a place where they were willing to let him go and go wherever he wanted, and he got all of his money. I think I don't think he gave up any money on that buyout.
No.
I mean, he may have taken, like, what he would have gotten paid in Houston, like, less money, but he didn't, like, have to give, like, right now, the reason Andre Iguodala is still on the Grizzlies is because the Grizzlies are like, if you want out of this contract, you're going to buy your way out, and not for $2 million where you can get elsewhere. We want you to, like, take a big cut, you know. That's not going amicably, at least right now.
Thing that Carmelo just really needed to have said in that interview, Brian, is just, I didn't play well enough. And in some ways, because again, I think that he deserves a lot of credit. And I said this all throughout that year. He was attempting to change. A lot of people kept saying, it's just Melo won't change. He won't do things differently. He took more threes and made more threes than he ever had in his whole career. He took more catch and shoots. His ISOs were down. His mid-range jumpers were down. He was beginning that transition of trying to become a different player. It was clear that he was doing it through gritted teeth and was not that comfortable doing it. And you could see that both reflected on the floor and then with what he was also publicly saying. But he was kind of so-so in Oklahoma City. And then he went to Houston and he was just kind of flat out bad. And I think that Carmelo Anthony just needed to sit down and say, look, things didn't work out in those places, but a lot of that had to do with the fact that I was uncomfortable in the role I was playing, and I played it poorly. And I think that that would have done him more service than trying to kind of justify the reasons that it didn't work.
Right. And, you know, look, I'm not going to – the situation in New York, both parties were guilty there. You know, Phil Jackson trying to implement – you know, Phil Jackson signing Carmelo to a five-year max contract and then trying to force a system down his throat that didn't fit the way he played. But it ended badly in New York. By his own, you know, his own comments, he's making it sound like it ended badly in Oklahoma City, and it clearly ended badly in Houston. So his last three stops, it ended badly, and he is, you know, not been afraid to – you know, to criticize all three places. So that's what I'm saying. That's the problem. So, like, well, I appreciate what he's doing, and I appreciate him trying to be forthcoming. Like, if you're a GM sitting there, are you like, boy, you know, he's just ripped the last couple of places he was. This is a risk anyway. You know, like, you could make the argument that the Hawks would do better than using their last roster spot than on a 42-year-old Vince Carter. But Vince Carter will be a a value added to your roster, whether he, you know, he played 76 games last year. I doubt he plays that many this year, but whether he's a real, you know, core player or not. And I just think that there's too much doubt around Carmelo about whether he can do that, despite his bad desire, his desire to badly desire to do that. And so it's just, you know, I have a couple of friends who are just really big Knicks fans who just worship Carmelo. And when Carmelo says, how can I not help a team? How can I not be an eight or ninth man on a team? Like they all agree. So, like, this is, you know, they basically bring up kind of like, he's being blackballed. There's something else going on, you know, and I mean, maybe there is, but to my knowledge, there isn't. I just think that it didn't work out the last three places he was, and, you know, the way his makeup and the way he is built made it hard. You know, it's kind of not unlike Allen Iverson, who was out of the league relatively early. Iverson, you know, his nature, the way he played the game and his nature made it hard for him to age gracefully. His size also made it hard for him to age gracefully. But his nature, it just didn't work. And he tried a couple of teams, you know, tried to bring him back, and it didn't last because it just wasn't who he was. And it didn't make him any lesser of a player when he was in his prime, but that could just be where Carmelo is. And, you know, he got 15 years. You know, so.
But this is that case. Is kind of what Kevin was saying, Brian, is that, you know, he almost has too much star power for his own good. Is that if he had kind of gone through a process of reducing the Carmelo Anthony brand, the Carmelo Anthony aura, and what comes with him, and if he was more seen as just a guy that you could add onto your team and could be a 36% 3-point shooter, play 16 minutes a night, and contribute to your roster. And that's what he was viewed as, then he would have a job. He would be on a team right now because he can add to a basketball team. I'm pretty convinced of that. I think he's still a capable scorer. It's just that when you sign him, you don't sign that statistical line. You sign Carmelo Anthony. And that's what's difficult. And honestly, I don't know that that's entirely Carmelo's fault. I don't know that that's all on him. I think that there's also just a perception of him that he, and some of it's because of like the interview that he did, the things that he said in various spots, but he hasn't been able to break down that door. And I think that's some on him. And I think that's just some on just kind of the way it is when you build that level of star power.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right. Well, thank you very much, Royce. Thank you to Kevin, who had to leave us a little bit ago. And thank you to you guys for coming back and listening. I'll be with Team USA as long as I can be. Still no Chinese visa. So, government of China, please allow me to come to your country. No, we're not going to say anything negative, Royce.
Wow. No, Royce, yeah, that's great.
I would be very honored if the government of China would grant me permission to come and cover the World Cup of basketball and Team USA and all the other fine NBA players. I would be very appreciative if they would grant me a visa. And I will, as they request, come in at the very last minute and leave immediately after it's over. I will not come early or stay late. I would appreciate that. Don't have it yet. So maybe I'll be with them in China and we can do a podcast from China, or maybe I won't be. We'll see. But thanks for listening to the Hoop Collective podcast, and have a great week, everybody.